最近中共在台海动作频频，除了出动陆海空火箭军举行环台军演之外，一名解放军前海军军官独自驾驶快艇从福建穿越台湾海峡，长驱直入台北的淡水河口，距离台湾总统府只有20多公里，令专家们担心台湾的海防是否出现了漏洞。前美国国防部副助理部长甚至还警告，解放军有可能在无预警的情况之下对台湾发动突袭。前白宫副国家安全顾问伯明 Matt Pottinger 与前日本自卫舰队司令官香田洋二等多位重量级的学者，在即将出版的新书《沸腾的护城河》The Boiling Moat 当中，详细的列出了美国、日本以及澳大利亚协防台湾的紧急步骤，目标是将台湾海峡打造成一条固若金汤的护城河，增加北京攻台付出的代价。习近平是否真的准备要武力犯台？美国和印太地区的盟友要如何破解中共的攻台计划呢？请看本期纵深视角与前美国副国家安全顾问伯明的专访。我们今天很高兴为您邀请到前美国副国家安全顾问伯明先生来到美国之音的演播室接受我们的访问。伯明先生，非常欢迎您。
谢谢您的邀请，非常感谢能来到美国之音参加您的采访。
您的中文非常流利，然后您的经历也非常特别。在进入白宫担任副国家安全顾问之前，您曾经当过新闻记者和陆战队员，还有到阿富汗和伊拉克参战。你在白宫和台湾发表过两篇令人非常印象深刻的中文演讲，可不可以先跟我们讲一下你的中文为什么说得这么好？
现在说得不好了，真的。我以前在国立台湾大学学了一年中文，我的老师非常优秀，我也很努力的学习，但是这几年来我的中文的能力已经退步了很多，所以丢脸的是我，不是我的老师。
或许要到台湾去，可以再多多的练习。OK，Let's talk about your forthcoming book. On the book cover, there's also a Chinese character, 金城汤池。What does that mean?
So, 金城汤池 comes from a Han Dynasty phrase from the autobiography of Kuai Tong.Kuai Tong was a statesman who advised that even powerful armies should not attack strong points. Cities, for example, on border regions that have really strong defenses and boiling moats, as he put it. So I borrowed that phrase for the cover because that's the metaphor that I think is even betterthan the metaphor of a porcupine. Sometimes people talk about how Taiwan should be a porcupine. It's sharp and has quills, and it would be very dangerous for someone to try to swallow a porcupine. But really, the most important piece of geography that defends Taiwan is that 100-mile Taiwan Strait. And if the People's Republic of China decides that it wants to blockade or attack and try to conquer Taiwan, the most dangerous part of that journey will be crossing that Taiwan Strait. So Taiwan working with Japan, working of course with the United States and Australia, can turn the Taiwan Strait into a boiling moat that should deter Xi Jinping, the dictator in Beijing, from attempting to conquer Taiwan.
So before we discuss more about how to take those urgent steps to defend Taiwan in this book, The Boiling Moat, I'd like to ask two fundamental questions. First, would Xi Jinping really take the high risk to invade Taiwan even with its weak economy? And second, what would America and the world lose if CCP took Taiwan?
Yeah, well, look, Xi Jinping is not what I would call a reckless gambler. He's someone who likes to calculate before he takes very risky steps. As some people like to say, 他是走一步看一步. So I think that If we look carefully, though, at the rhetoric that he's using and also the steps he's taking to prepare his military, we should take extremely seriously his threat to try to subjugate Taiwan. He has said that his vision, which he calls the Chinese dream, 中国梦, the Chinese dream of the great rejuvenation of the Chinese nation, is at its essence. He has said that its essence is unification, 统一. So I don't think that those are idle threats. I think that he's expressing his vision, much the same way that Vladimir Putin expressed his vision to attack and destroy and annex Ukraine, which he's attempting to do. If we had listened carefully to what Vladimir Putin had written and said in his key speeches and essays in the lead up, we would not have been so surprised that he decided to wage war. The same is true with Xi Jinping. Mm-hmm. What would we lose?
Yes.
Yeah, quite a lot. I think that the look at how badly the world has been disrupted by the war in Ukraine and the violence in the Middle East. Those are not nearly as disruptive as an attack on Taiwan would be for geopolitics, for the world economy, for the prosperity and security and freedom of people throughout Asia, but even across the Pacific and across the Eurasian landmass in Europe and in the United States. It's about really the nature of governance in the world. Democracy has done quite well over in the post World War II era. Mm-hmm. Right now, democracy is under threat around the world. Taking action to violently subjugate Taiwan would be a major blow to democracy, not only in Taiwan, not only in Asia, but really throughout the world.
The PLA just had a very sophisticated military exercise in the Taiwan Strait. Even with a training ground, which looks like the Taiwan's presidential palace.
Yeah.
You just mentioned that you have some steps we can take to make this Taiwan Strait a boiling moat, like the title of your book. But what if the PLA used blockade?
Yeah. So there are two kinds of blockades. If the PLA decides that it wants to do a naval blockade, similar to what it just rehearsed following President Lai's inauguration, and following the Speaker Nancy Pelosi's visit a couple summers ago, the Navy of China still has to expose itself in ways that are quite risky if it wants to sustain a blockade, not just demonstrate a short capability, a flash blockade like it did last week, but if it really wants to demonstrate a long-term attempt to strangle Taiwan. Taiwan has the ability, the technology exists, it even has some of these weapons, but it doesn't have the weapons in enough supply, and it hasn't trained enough with these weapons and coordinated enough with Japan and the United States and Australia. But it has the ability to threaten China's maritime forces. Blockades are not easy to successfully carry out, right? The history of blockades is an interesting one. It's you can run a blockade with big ships that are a lot bigger than the warships that China's using. So the onus that is then on the one conducting the blockade to escalate and become even more violent in ways that could invite a very significant counter strategy, perhaps the United States sending troops to Taiwan, moving to mobilize our own military and Japan's military to counteract that. Now, there's another kind of blockade, which is a missile blockade. This is harder to defend against for Taiwan. This would be if China is using missiles from inland, not using its navy to stop ships, but simply sinking ships that approach Taiwan. So it's very hard to deny China that ability, but you can punish that kind of a blockade by, in essence, expanding the blockade to include all of China and not just allow Taiwan to be the one who suffers from the blockade.
Mm-hmm. Matt, you visited Taiwan last summer with a delegation from Israel.
Yes.
We know that Taiwan Strait is very different, you know, geographically from Middle East or Ukraine. Any lessons Taiwan can learn from those war zones to defend itself?
Yeah. Well, I think there's several lessons. One is that Taiwan's geography is a huge blessing. Even though it's close to its adversary, the mm-hmm. People's Republic of China, it is separated by 100 miles of water. It is not easy to land on Taiwan with a hostile force. There aren't many beaches that are suitable for that. Taiwan can defend its ports in ways that would make it very difficult for those ports to be subjugated. What would Israel have given, or what would Ukraine have given, to have a 100-mile stretch of ocean separating it from its adversaries? And so Taiwan first should take heart that it is blessed with a natural set of defenses. Some of the other lessons that we discussed when these retired Israeli generals and colonels, and we had a former Israeli national security advisor come to Taiwan, was really about military culture and the civilian military culture and how important of a role that plays in the defense of underdog states like Taiwan. Israel has never lost a war that it has fought, despite very difficult odds, despite at various points in its history being surrounded by aggressors and still facing a very potent aggressor in the form of Iran. The war that Israel's fighting right now is really a war against Iran that's being waged by Iranian proxies. So whereas Taiwan had a lot of interest in these conversations with the Israelis about technology, things like
Iron Dome
and David's Sling and these very impressive systems that Israel employs. The Israelis wanted to talk to Taiwan about reserve training and the reserve force. They wanted to talk about personnel because personnel is the building block for an effective defense. And the Israelis were concerned that Taiwan has too large of a reserve force that is not well enough trained. In other words, it would be better to shrink the force, the reserve force, but to train much more frequently, use more realistic training, have clearer senses of how the reserves would support Taiwan's very capable professional active duty forces. And so a lot of the focus was on that. We have a chapter in the book that one of the Israelis who came to Taiwan contributed to that chapter, writing about the need for a change in Taiwan's military culture. I think that chapter is actually very important.
In addition to Taiwan's job, let's also talk about what U.S. and its ally can do to make sure Xi Jinping, when he wakes up in the morning, he would feel like today, tomorrow, and the next day are not good times to execute his plan to invade Taiwan.
Yeah.
What can we do?
Oh, well, the United States has enormous capabilities to bring to bear. I'm actually quite optimistic. Having done this research that went into the book, and having worked with an excellent group of co-authors and others that I've consulted, I'm actually quite optimistic that we can together deter this conflict, but it does require us to take steps that we've not yet taken. These steps include procuring proper munitions that both Taiwan needs to procure, but the United States needs to revamp its defense industrial base to make much more armaments, particularly missiles, and to make them faster, torpedoes and missiles and anti-ship missiles of various types. We already have the technology. We already have these most of what we need in our arsenals, just not in sufficient supply to demonstrate to the dictator in Beijing that we can stay in a fight. Not only that we can fight for the first days or the first weeks, but for months, and if necessary, even longer than that. And so we don't want Xi Jinping to be optimistic that he can outlast mm-hmm. us in a conflict. The less optimistic he is, the less likely he is to undertake this kind of a mission. Mm-hmm. So I'm happy to talk about some of the specific types of things that we need to add to the arsenal. Mm-hmm. The details are in the book if you don't want to go too deep for our purposes today.
But I do have a specific question from chapter 2, because you mentioned in February 2022, just months before his assassination, Japan's former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe suggested the idea of nuclear sharing for the nuclear weapon to be stored in Japan under U.S. custody, but can be delivered by nuclear-capable aircraft operated by both Japan and the United States. Do you think that we should employ the Cold War strategy, the mutually assured destruction mat, or nuclear umbrella to deter Beijing from invading Taiwan?
Well, look, I actually think that the idea that the late Prime Minister Abe raised is one that is worth discussing, that Japan and the United States should be talking about these ideas. We should be flexible in thinking about the sorts of things that we want to bring to the table. One of the lessons that Beijing may have drawn from the war in mm-hmm. Ukraine is that the U.S. could be mistaken for being intimidated by nuclear brinksmanship. I think that it would be wise for us to demonstrate that we are not intimidated mm-hmm. by nuclear brinksmanship. It would be wise for us to show Beijing that it's not going to get what it wants by threatening us with the world's most destructive weapons, mm-hmm. That we have our own nuclear arsenal, and we have the means to ensure that we keep it that conflict out of the nuclear domain.
Mm-hmm. We know that effective deterrence requires not only the capability, mm-hmm. but also leaders' will.
Yes.
We know President Biden has said 4 times the commitment of U.S. forces to defend Taiwan. And the former President Trump even suggested that he would bomb Beijing if, you know, China attacked Taiwan. Which deterrence do you think is more credible deterrence for Xi Jinping, in your opinion?
Well, look, President Biden, I think it was wise to declare his intention to defend Taiwan. I think it would be wise for future presidents and presidential candidates to not back away from the new baseline that was established by President Biden when he said, as you just mentioned, 4 times that he would commit U.S. Yes. forces in the event that mm-hmm. Beijing attacked Taiwan. Ultimately, Beijing will make a calculation based on what U.S. presidents say, but also what U.S. presidents do. And that's why it's so important for President Biden and for his successor, whoever that may be, whether it's President Trump at the end of this year winning mm-hmm. election or it's a future president, we have to show that we have the capability to mm-hmm. back up the expressions of resolve that we've heard 4 times from President Biden, and that I think we've heard from President Trump as well. I spoke to President Trump many times when we were in office about Taiwan. I think he understands the gravity of that situation and what a disaster it would be for U.S. Mm-hmm. interests and our prosperity and our mm-hmm. safety if China were to attack Taiwan. So I have a degree of confidence that mm-hmm. irrespective of who wins in November, Beijing probably should not should be very careful and think thrice, as the Chinese saying goes, before testing the resolve of an American president.
Since we're talking about the election, I just have a question: like, will this upcoming U.S. presidential election be taken into account when Xi Jinping makes his calculation? Because you just say that he's 走一步, 算一步, he's calculating the time or his plan to invade Taiwan. Will it be taken into account, the election?
Yeah, I think that he will certainly take into account the election. The main thing that he's going to be looking for are signs of disunity in the United States. Mm-hmm. And we're at a polarized moment. We've been here before at various points in our history. We were here in the 1970s. We were here in the 1930s. At various points in the 19th century, you know, American history is cyclical. And what encourages aggression is a sense of grave disunity in the home of your adversary. And Beijing clearly regards the United States as its primary adversary. The Communist Party has regarded us as an adversary for more than 30 years, even as we've gone way out of our way to help make China stronger through exchanges and trade and investment. Nonetheless, Beijing has chose the United States as an adversary. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's very important that we maintain unity, that whoever loses the election has to accept that loss, and we need to move on and ensure that we have continuity and demonstrate that our politics should go back to the old saying of Senator Vandenberg, which is that politics should end at the water's edge in America. We can have our internal disputes, but when it comes to the important role that the United States plays in the world as a leader, with strong alliances, we should not let our internal politics spill over in ways that distract us and our allies and that encourage our enemies.
Okay. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin met with his Chinese counterpart at the Shangri-La dialogue. And Austin said the war with China is not imminent nor unavoidable, while his counterpart Dong Jun warned that anyone seeking to separate Taiwan from China will face the self-destruction. The word he used is 自取灭亡，粉身碎骨. What do you make of this dialogue?
Well, I think it's good that the U.S. Secretary of Defense is meeting with someone in the Chinese system. Mm-hmm. The Chinese Minister of Defense is not, strictly speaking, equal to the U.S. Secretary of Defense. The Chinese Minister is a much more junior person in that system because it's not a republic in the classical sense. Mm-hmm. It is a Communist Party dictatorship, and so it would be better if Secretary Austin were meeting with the vice chairs of the Communist Party Central Military Commission. They are closer to Xi Jinping than the Minister of Defense is. Nonetheless, I support this channel. I think it's a channel of dialogue worth having. Mm-hmm. The very bellicose remarks made by the Chinese minister were taken with a sense of alarm by people throughout the region. It's regrettable that he's saber-rattling the way that he is. But I also have some sympathy for him because he's in one of the most dangerous jobs in the world, just judging from what's happened to his predecessor and to other ministers in China who tend to disappear with increasing regularity. Other generals tend to disappear in the Chinese system with increasing regularity. So we're seeing something that reminds me of Joseph Stalin's reign, where people just disappear into thin air and there's no comment about where they came. So I'm sure that he was probably in a very difficult position having to sound strident because he's probably more concerned with what's happening in Beijing than he is with what's happening in the United States.
You just remind me of your earlier interview with the Financial Times. Yeah, just like you said, you compare Xi Jinping to Stalin, you know, in terms of the military purges. And you also predicted that Xi Jinping would, like Stalin, pass away while in office. Can you share with us more of your thoughts on this?
Well, look, you know, Mao Zedong was heavily influenced by the ideology and the governing style of Joseph Stalin. Xi Jinping has been very heavily influenced by Mao Zedong's governing style and ideology. Right. And the common thread through it, which has been described most eloquently by my friend John Garneau, who's based in Australia, is that it is an ideology that draws from the old Stalinist book, The Short Course on the History of the Bolshevik Revolution, which talks about this idea that the party must constantly purge its ranks in order to maintain the party's monopoly of political power. And as you know, if we look at Xi Jinping's governance for the last dozen years or so that he's been in power, that's very much the playbook that he's chosen to use. He came in and immediately launched a purge. Many of my Chinese friends predicted that or forecast that it would be a 6 month to a 12 month power consolidation exercise. Here we are 12 years later. The purges continue. And this is really a Stalinist kind of approach. And of course, Xi is applying that to the military, not for the first time. He is destroying the ranks of his general officer corps. It's not entirely clear why. I suspect that a major part of it is that he doesn't feel that he has the precise team in place that he needs to wage war against Taiwan and the United States and Japan, which would be, I'm quite confident, involved in that war, and other powers. So I take it both as a symptom of a defective system, but also an alarming indicator that Xi Jinping is in fact preparing for war. Both things are true at once.
You mentioned Mao Zedong. I remember Mao Zedong said, 天下大乱,形势大好. The situation is excellent with the chaos under heaven. Yeah. And Xi Jinping also believes he's facing an opportunity of the century, 百年未有之大变局. What is your assessment of his axis of chaos with so many proxy wars in multiple theaters right now?
Well, it's very clear that Xi Jinping, when he came into power 12 years ago, he wanted to see things develop in a way that created some degree of chaos external to China in order to create the opportunity to expand Chinese influence, Chinese Communist Party influence overseas. And that's actually how things have played out. If you read his internal textbooks, the scholar in Washington, D.C., Ian Easton, found a whole series of Xi Jinping thought textbooks that are taught to Chinese generals at the National Defense University. They talk about a situation that they view as favorable, which includes the United States growing weaker in their view, Europe becoming chaotic, and Russia becoming aggressive. And so that is, in fact, the scenario that Xi Jinping has encouraged with his no limits pact with Vladimir Putin, with his overwhelming support for the war in Europe. Our Secretary of State, Tony Blinken, said in Beijing just several weeks ago that China is the overwhelming number one supplier of the war machine in Russia, and that Russia would not probably have been able to sustain its war in Ukraine if not for Xi Jinping's support. So this is, in effect, a Chinese Communist Party proxy war.
Yes.
With Russia as its puppet, its marionette proxy, fighting a war against Europe and Europe's allies. The same is true, the same playbook as what Beijing has put in place in the Middle East. It is the number one supporter of Iran, this terrorist state, in effect. Iran is an amazing civilization, amazing people, but it's run by a terrorist, an arch-terrorist, Ayatollah, and their various terrorist proxies. So Beijing is the number one economic supporter of the Ayatollah. It is the number one propaganda supporter in the world of the Ayatollah. And it's the number one diplomatic supporter of the Ayatollah. And now increasingly, even of its terrorist proxies. Beijing is now hosting terrorist groups to come to Beijing. So it's very clear what Beijing's doing. I think we should have no illusions about that.
Okay. Rosh Doshi, the former senior deputy director for China in National Security Council. He believes that China and U.S. are, you know, CCP and Xi Jinping are interested in the constructive engagement and peaceful coexistence with the United States. But you believe that America's competition with China must be won, not managed. What are the difference between his views and yours?
Sure.
Are we having a China policy debate?
Yeah, there's a debate going on right now. It was kicked off in part by an article that Congressman Mike Gallagher and I authored in Foreign Affairs Magazine. Recently, and it's provoked a fair bit of debate. Rush Doshi is a friend. He's I think, a terrific scholar and former official. Rush, in his rebuttal of our foreign affairs piece, I think is representing the Biden administration's view, which is to defend its record, which up to a point is defensible. I think that the first 2 years that President Biden was in office, He pursued a policy that was really an intensification, continuity and intensification of President Trump's policy, which was to regard, start imposing more costs on Beijing for things that it does to damage U.S. interests. He maintained the tariffs that President Trump put in place. He increased the export controls to ensure that Beijing doesn't become the world's dominant semiconductor manufacturer. These are all good steps, but there's some important things that changed over the last few years that President Biden's been in office that now necessitate a change in our policy. Mm-hmm. Namely, deterrence is failing. We're now seeing Beijing wage these proxy wars. We have a major war in Europe. We have a growing conflagration in the Middle East. Beijing is on the side of the aggressors in both of those. Beijing is threatening the Philippines. Beijing is threatening Taiwan directly. It's even supporting the dictator in Venezuela, Maduro, as he threatens to attack his neighbor, Guyana. So we're in a very different situation. That wasn't the situation when President Trump was in office. We did not see a cascading collapse of deterrence. And therefore, we need to pivot to a more confrontational policy. Where I disagree, in addition to that broad stroke, I disagree with the Biden administration's shrinking of the U.S. defense budget. This is one of the most irresponsible steps by an American president since the 1930s. We have a smaller military today than we've had at any point since the eve of World War II. Our military budget has continually shrunk under President Biden when adjusted for inflation. And that is a signal of weakness. It's an invitation to aggressors to do their worst. And so I think this is one of my, Mike Gallagher and I have a significant difference with the Biden administration on that front. But then there's also the view that that we see in Biden administration officials or former officials in their rhetoric that suggests that if we don't work really hard to try to cooperate with Beijing, we might have some kind of an escalatory spiral. In other words, the idea that if we're not accommodating to some degree, Beijing will grow more aggressive. But history tells us that exactly the opposite is true. If we look at the history of the Cold War with the Soviet Union, it was during times when the U.S. was tougher that the relationship with the Soviet Union became more manageable. So, and conversely, in the 1970s, when the U.S. pursued a so-called détente, a set of détente policies over the course of a few administrations in the 70s, the Soviet Union became more aggressive. So when it said, okay, the Americans want to cooperate with us in these areas, we'll use those talks to induce complacency in the United States while we grow our military and actually conduct more aggressive proxy wars and direct wars abroad. So what happened over the course of our détente policy? Russia undertook wars in Africa. It began backing European communist movements. It showed up right in the U.S.'s backyard in Latin America and in the Caribbean again. And then it finally just invaded Afghanistan. And so the fruits of detente were more aggression, not less. And so I think we should learn from that. I would argue that the Biden administration's policy since early 2023 has slouched into some kind of a neo-detente. Mm-hmm. Rush Doshi disagrees with me. He's entitled to his view. I respect him. But I think that's where we're at.
Well, we're trying to be a student of history and the detente. I think another argument of Rush Doshi, also very important to address, please allow me to quote him here. He said, American objectives do not require China's political transformation, and there is no guarantee that the end of a communist rule will produce a more restrained China. The end of communist Russia, after all, eventually gave way to Putin's Russia. What's your view on China's regime change? Are you betting on China's collapse, just like Rush Doshi said?
Well, first, let's look at, I'll come to that idea in just a moment, mm-hmm. but to suggest that we should not have waged or tried to win the Cold War because 30 years later, some dictator would emerge in the form of Vladimir Putin call it a penny-wise, pound-foolish policy, right? I mean, we're much better off. The United States and the world have been much better off for decades since the collapse of the Soviet Union. No question about it. Now we're dealing with a revanchist dictator who grew up under the Soviet system as a KGB officer. What we're getting is an aftershock, you know, a bit of a peptic ulcer that has remained from the Cold War. But we should not say that we shouldn't have actually waged a winning strategy in the Cold War just because Vladimir Putin's going to be around for a few more years. Mm-hmm. We're much better off in our current situation than we were in the 1970s, let's say. Mm-hmm. Now, the strategy that Mike Gallagher and I put forward does not require it doesn't promote an American inducement of regime change. Mm-hmm. If China is going to undergo regime change, that's going to be something decided by the Chinese people. We don't think we should be fearful of that. We actually think that if the Chinese people decide to go that direction, we should give them support. But we don't see that process underway. We don't call for outright subversion or regime change in our article. What we do is call for a more hard-nosed policy that imposes more substantial costs on Beijing for its aggression, aggression that did not exist when I was in office, when I first worked for President Trump in refashioning U.S. strategy. The situation is very different today when you have the near threat of a war in Taiwan, mm-hmm. the threat against the Philippines, and proxy wars against us in the Middle East and in Europe. Therefore, what we should be doing is imposing much steeper costs and looking back and taking some inspiration from the thinking of George Kennan at the beginning of the Cold War in the late 1940s. He didn't call for a regime change strategy. Mm-hmm. What he said, however, he made an observation, which turned out to be prescient. He said that if the Soviet Union is unable to achieve its global vision and aims, and he said that the United States should employ a containment strategy to ensure that the Soviets don't achieve those aims, but if the Soviet Union failed in its broader vision, it might actually collapse from within under its own rotten weight, as he put it. And so what Mike Gallagher and I were writing was really a revisiting of Kennan's original thought. I don't know why people are troubled by that as much as some have been on the left in particular, and some others on the right as well. It is really about ensuring that Beijing does not achieve its global vision, because that vision is intensely hostile to democracy worldwide.
I think we should also spend some time talk about Chinese democracy in the future, because in May 4th, 2020, you deliver a speech in Chinese in the White House.
Yes.
I remember so clearly that you said the notion that Chinese people cannot have democracy is nonsense. 一派胡言。
中国传统思想中对领导的品德要求。张彭春和胡适都知道，中国人不适合民主，不过是一派胡言。
一派胡言。
一派胡言。
It is. I'll go farther than that. I would say that it's a racist notion. That Chinese people cannot have democracy. And it's a racist notion encouraged by the Chinese Communist Party. They want to say that Chinese people are just different. They can't experience democracy. They're not capable of governing themselves. They need to have, an emperor. This is ridiculous. And we've seen people all over the world build successful democracies. We've seen Taiwan, which is a unique society, but one that also shares a strong Chinese heritage, right? And a lot of common cultural heritage. Build one of the most successful democracies in history. Taiwan ranks above the United States and the United Kingdom and above all other Asian democracies on various democratic indices like the Economist Intelligence Unit and things of that nature. So very clearly, it is a lie that the Chinese people cannot build and enjoy and sustain self-government. I'm confident that eventually the Chinese people will prove me right on that point.
Actually, Matt, you also mentioned that in your book, The Boiling Mode, the 2022, the white paper, young protesters on the street, and they were accused by Beijing's leader of manipulating by the foreign forces. But those young people on the street, they argue that actually it was CCP influence by those foreign forces, such as Marx, Engels, and Lenin. You know?
That's right.
So with more and more younger generation waking up in China and starting to learn the truth of history and finally realize the CCP and China are two different concepts.
Yeah. Look, the Chinese Communist Party is a foreign dynasty. Mm-hmm. It is one of China's foreign dynasties. The Mongols, the Manchus, and the Chinese Communist Party. What they have in common are that they've imported external ideology. And in the case of the Chinese Communist Party, they've imported an ideology from Europe. In fact, the Chinese Communist Party is the least Chinese government that China's ever had. It's less Chinese than what the Mongols had in the Yuan dynasty. It's less Chinese than what the Manchus brought in the Qing, because it is a whole lock, stock, and barrel wholesale importation of Marxism-Leninism, which is a threadbare, failed European ideology. So I think that many people across China understand this. I think the Chinese Communist Party knows it, which is why they go to such lengths to try to malign the democracy in Taiwan and to try to discredit democracy in other parts of the world. But ultimately, where China goes will be something much more Chinese than Marxism-Leninism. I don't know what it will be. It will be something that's influenced by traditional Chinese thought and philosophy and religion. I've been reading Confucius recently, The Analects. I think that if you look at the ideas that Confucius was promoting, these very powerful ideas, the idea of ceremony and rites, li, humaneness, ren, the idea of reciprocity, shu, the idea of education, self-improvement, xue, and the idea that people must play the roles properly that they are assigned in life, or that there's in their stations, a father to his son and a son's role to his father, an official's role to society and the society's role to the official. None of these things are incompatible with self-government and democracy that I can find. I'm sure that there'll be some Confucian scholars who disagree with that, but I'm partway through the Analects right now. So far, I'm not seeing anything that's incompatible. In fact, what I'm seeing are Chinese characteristics mm-hmm. that could make democracy especially successful mm-hmm. in a Chinese society. Mm-hmm. These ideas, you know, Confucianism is still alive and well in South Korea in certain degrees. Mm-hmm. Confucianism had a big impact on Japan and its history. South Korea is a vibrant democracy that has borrowed and adopted and transformed Confucian ideals. So is Japan, Taiwan to some extent. Mm-hmm. So what's the problem here? I think that if we mine Chinese culture and ancient wisdom, you start to find the building blocks for something that is more liberal and something that is more democratic mm. and something that is more humane than a totalitarian dictatorship like we're seeing today in Beijing.
Finally, Matt, very quickly, tell us, what's America's best strategy to win this, not only for the United States, for Taiwan, but also for Chinese people and the free world?
Well, first, the Chinese people are our best allies in this competition that we're in with China. And I think it's important for Taiwan to remember that as well and to do even more to reach out to people across the Taiwan Strait to ensure that Taiwan's story is being told as best as possible, even given the Great Firewall and all of Beijing's efforts to try to silence voices from Taiwan. Taiwan should make the extra effort, just as the United States should make the extra effort in every language to try to tell our stories well to the Chinese people. That's got to be part of the strategy.
好的，非常感谢伯明先生今天接受美国之音的专访，非常非常感谢您，谢谢您。
樊栋，您非常感谢。
谢谢。